with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and it is cussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! It is a beautiful, beautiful afternoon in the hills today. Simply stunning. High blue skies, July warm, the green of the trees fairly shimmering in the afternoon light. I gotta admit, it's one of those days that makes it kind of tough to come inside and crawl behind the microphone. But no hooky for Bob. No. Because there's stuff going on. Stuff for us to talk about. Stuff for us to consider, to cuss and discuss. And I gotta, now if I'm, by way of an excuse. Oh, by the way, I keep screwing this up. If you stuck around after Malloy, welcome to the program. I've been welcoming people, like, in the last minute of the program, and I'm thinking that's not working so good. No, I'm kidding. But, no, welcome. Welcome. If you're listening on the Malloy rerun stream, welcome. Hope you'll feel free to participate, join in, and have a blast with the rest of us. If you're ever around during the hours of the live program, which is 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, as it is right now, in the fall, it'll be Eastern Standard Time. It's 6 o'clock, either way you slice it. I guess that doesn't make much difference, except for maybe people in Indiana and Arizona. But anyway, 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Pop into the chat room. It's free and easy. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com/chatroom. Of course, also at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, we have blogs. We have forums. No, you are not Chopped Liver, Texas Betsy. But I've been doing my welcoming where did that come from? What are we, Chopped Liver? It's an old phrase, but my gracious. Have you ever had good chopped liver? Oh, yeah, with the schmaltz and, oh, mercy, a little bit of onion and garlic chopped in it, salt, black pepper. There's no better, you know, the rest, you know, if you want to charge extra for it, you don't call it chopped liver, you call it pate. Why is that the demeaning kind? No, it's chopped like chopped liver's comment. No, it's a delight. And if my doctor knew that I'd ever even eaten it, he'd probably have a conniption. Yeah, I know. What am I, chopped liver? No. Maybe given the culture that it comes from, chopped liver was on the table every day and it was just common, but it's not anymore. I've made it a few times. But anyway, that's not where I was going. No, I was saying that if I'm a little bit scattered brain today, it's because I was up all night. Bless his heart, Horn Forum moderator Lottie stayed in the chat room, as did for most of the time chat room den mother ELO, Sue, as I attempted to get the production machine back to life here, the main computer that runs the whole affair, and went south a couple of weeks ago. Well, it appeared to have come back to life, and so I spent a good deal of time, I think I got to bed about sunrise, getting that thing back, and it was running beautifully, seeing everything that it was supposed to see, doing everything that it was supposed to do. Shut it down, came back in, turned it on, bupkis. Same problem. So that's been a big part of my day. But also another part of my day has involved just sort of keeping an eye on the Sotomayor hearings. Is there a more loathsome individual in the United States Senate? And I know there are a bunch of loathsome individuals in the United States Senate. There are a bunch of members of the United States Senate that you would not leave your children around. They are Republicans, of course. And I mean, there's some genuine crazy bastards. I mean, you got when you're talking about a fraternity that includes people like Dr. Tom Coburn, who's all worked up about lesbianism in our Oklahoma junior high schools. When you've got Jim Demented from South Carolina, and the Senate's biggest closet case, Lindsey Graham, also from South Carolina. When you've got Jim Inhofe from Oklahoma, wow, we're just focusing on Oklahoma and South Carolina, aren't we? Crazies. And then there's Brownback from Kansas. He's a loon. John Ensign from Nevada manifests his family values by sponsoring a defense of marriage amendment while he's banging away at his best friend's wife. I mean, there's a lot. David Vitter, Diaper Dave from Louisiana. Yeah, there's a lot of loonies and crazies and evils in the United States Senate among the Republican Party. But for at least today, and yesterday, the real topper has to go to Senator Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III, who did not disappoint today. No, he did not disappoint today. He, in his just deliciously bigoted smarminess, saw fit to lecture Supreme Court Justice nominee Sonia Sotomayor. And said she's unsuitable for the bench. Well, if anybody should recognize anyone else as unsuitable for the bench, it would be Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III. After all, he was found unsuitable for the bench. That was 1986. The Senate Judiciary Committee, on which he sits, found him, and this is the phrase, a quote, grossly insensitive on racial issues. And he sat there with a straight face looking at the committee in much the same seat that Sonia Sotomayor is now in, and admittedly, I frequently joke in an off-color sort of way. Yeah. Yeah, just a few minutes of the... A few minutes of the exchange here, if you wish.
You voted not to reconsider the prior case. You voted to stay with the decision of the circuit. And, in fact, your vote was the key vote. Had you voted with Judge Cabranes, himself of Puerto Rican ancestry, had you voted with him, you could have changed that case. So.
Yeah. You get the idea. He wants all Puerto Ricans to vote the same. Well, they all vote the same to me. Yeah, you know how that goes. Racists is racists is racists is racists. But that's a general idea of where we're going and where we will go this evening. But right now we're going to take a quick break because I have, as I promised you last night, a guest coming on the line. And I had to get the program started before I could get him on the line. We're going to be hearing from a human rights lawyer in just a moment. His name is Bob Amsterdam. So stick around for that. And, hey, Senator Ensign, This one's for you. Thank you. Issues attendant upon getting our guest on the line have been solved. Welcome back to the program. On the line with me now, by the way, as promised last night before the program ended, an internationally known human rights lawyer. His name is Bob Amsterdam. And Bob has a long and storied career addressing issues relating to human rights in various and sundry far corners of the globe. We will hear more about that here presently. But tomorrow, Bob is involved in a press conference featuring former Venezuelan judge Yuri Lopez and Venezuelan human rights lawyer Gonzalo Himeob. And they will discuss other human rights abuses present in Venezuela. It is my pleasure at this point in time to have Bob Amsterdam on the program with us. Bob, welcome to the program. Nice to see you again. Nice to talk to you again. It was good to see you in Washington, D.C. There we go.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's a real pleasure. You and I got to chat briefly on Radio Row back at the America's Future Now conference in D.C., and you talked to my colleague Guy James as well. You have been working on issues related to human rights abuses in Venezuela for some time, have you not?
Yes. In fact, I've been working in Venezuela for almost 10 years, and not just human rights, but also corporate rights. And dealing in the Venezuelan legal system has been always difficult, but since Chavez, a complete and total nightmare.
So I take it that you don't care much for Hugo Chavez in general principle.
Well, actually, it's kind of interesting. I think that when I was in Caracas in the early part of the century, I was pretty impressed with Hugo Chavez in terms of what I thought, and I think many others thought, he represented the inclusiveness, the sort of a new chance for a lot of the poor in Venezuela to have their voices finally heard. What happened, however, was quite another story. He has morphed into a typical old-style Latin American caudillo, and he has destroyed whatever green sprouts of the rule of law were beginning, and he has become a very serious political and energy threat, not only to the United States, but really in many ways to his own people. Many will be shocked to understand that the sort of Gini level of inequality in Venezuela has actually gone up under his presidency. as have many other indicia which demonstrate that rather than assisting the poor, as many of us believed he was intending to do, he has lined the pockets of many of the new oligarchs, as they've called, and he has really put the army and some of the more radical leftist groups in control of the country. It's a pretty frightening scenario.
So, he was swept into power on issues relating to reform, land reform, and issues relating, as you mentioned, to a level of increased at least cognizance and awareness and attention to the vast masses of the poor in Venezuela. What happened to that? Was it all talk, or was it just a means to an end? What?
You know, to be frank, a lot changed with the coup. In fact, almost everything changed with what happened in 2002 when he was removed and then brought back. It seems to have dramatically radicalized him and changed him. I spoke to a number of political prisoners in Venezuela who had actually been close boyhood friends of Chavez, and they said that the man that came back from that island for a few days was not even recognizable to them. And certainly since that time, he has been a crushing opponent of democracy. And, you know, often people talk about, well, he's had many elections, but they fail to mention how he's used blacklists to attack his opponents. He's used all of the administrative resources of the state to stack those elections. And he has used a tremendous power over the media and over the courts to personalize his rule and to attack those who would have the temerity to oppose his policies.
What of the Chavez government? What degree of what you described is do you think a product of his relationships with his neighbors, most particularly Colombia?
Very little. I think Chavez certainly isn't afraid of Colombia. In fact, many believe he's a sponsor of the FARC. I think some of the key relationships, interestingly enough, of Chavez that are incredibly important. Number one has to be his really intense relationship with Fidel Castro, both intense on a personal psychological level as well as on an economic and political level. And then, of course, he has these very close relationships both with with Russia, Iran, and with China.
And is that a function of the fact that he was so thoroughly demonized by the Bush administration in the 8 years of that administration?
Well,
I mean, he couldn't get close to us, therefore he went to the other side of the spectrum.
I don't actually think so. I'd like to think so because it's an easier explanation, but I don't think so. I think George Bush was exactly what he needed. This is a guy who lives to confront. He develops his identity very much by the kind of false threat he can put in front of him. And let me be clear, George Bush was a real threat, not a false threat. I mean, many believe there were some U.S. machinations even in respect to that coup. But it became pretty obvious that George Bush was to him something of a real benefit, because in so alienating not only Chavez but many of the other players in Latin America, in fact almost everybody but Lula, who for some reason Bush ended up getting along fairly well with, Bush was a dream for Chavez. He helped Chavez in terms of organizing ALBA, which is this sort of anti-U.S. network that Chavez has established. He helped Chavez in terms of working on the gas and oil interrelationships that Chavez has formed with Bolivia and Ecuador and Brazil. He was a great foil for Chavez. And in fact, you know, Chavez has had a reversal of fortune since the Obama administration has come in, because no one in Caracas believes Barack Obama is any sort of threat to Chavez, and they don't understand why his militancy has actually increased since Obama came to power.
That is very interesting. You mentioned relationships with places like Bolivia. What is the status How does the rest of the South American countries' democracies, such as they are, how are they responding to the Venezuelan government at present?
Well, interestingly, I just came back from Brazil, where, and I think it's quite a sign of the times, I was lobbying in Brazil in respect to a political prisoner in Venezuela, with the idea that actually lobbying in Brasilia was probably in many ways more important for my client than lobbying in Washington. And they had a kind of false notion of who Chavez is. But in Latin America, there's a very strong belief in non-interference in internal affairs in other countries. Lula is a big sponsor of that. And that isn't really consistent with international human rights law, and I would argue not very consistent with some other key aspects of international law, but it's a narrative that we face. And the truth is Chavez's regime is not held in high regard because it breaches that rule. Chavez is a meddler. He has his tentacles everywhere. You know, there were these riots in Peru. Chavez's people are implicated. The situation in Honduras has Chavez's fingerprints all over it. The situation in country after country in Latin America. You know about the suitcase trial in Florida where Chavez's folks were caught red-handed with millions of dollars in money for Kirchner that was found on a plane in Argentina. That ability of Chavez to meddle in the internal affairs of other countries hasn't won him a lot of plaudits. In fact, it's now commonly known in South America that if Chavez supports you, you lose not an insignificant percentage of the vote.
So with regard to the press conference tomorrow, obviously you have been, I assume, intimately involved in pressing the case of these political prisoners, most particularly Eligio Cedeño. What is the backstory for him, as well as the human rights lawyer Gonzalo Hinob and Yuri Lopez?
Well, Gonzalo and I wrote a white paper that's available on my blog at robertamsterdam.com. We wrote this white paper about the Cedeño case and political prisoners in Venezuela. And what was fascinating about this was that we were able to get inside the system in a fairly unique way. We interviewed some of the players who had put our client, Cedeño, who's been in jail without trial for 30 months. We actually managed to interview some of the judges and some of the people who had been involved in the case. And one of them, Judge Lopez, because she had allowed essentially a process begun by Cedeño to be accepted by the court, she was threatened by the Chavistas, and when she wouldn't give in one of her children, there was an actual attempt to kidnap one of her children, which she managed to stop at the last minute. But when she realized they were serious about taking her children, she fled to the United States. And she will be talking, and she has been speaking in Congress, about really the extent to which Chavez's justice system now has been completely hijacked. And what we're trying to do is shine a light on these political prisoners. And we want some conditionality in terms of negotiations or relationships with Chavez. We want countries to lobby that these political prisoners obtain fair trial rights and, in many cases, simply obtain release from what are completely arbitrary and totally unfair abuses of power that they've been subject to.
So Judge Lopez was on the and I imagine jurisprudential system in Venezuela is significantly different from what we imagine or are used to here. Judge Lopez was the presiding judge in the prosecution of Senor Cedeño. What is Senor Cedeño charged with?
He's charged with a number of currency and smuggling violations. that are connected to what's called CADIVI, which is a type of complex system that Venezuela has to deal with the transfer of dollars into bolivars. And what's kind of amusing about these charges are that while Cedeño's been locked up for 30 months, the state oil company has been engaged in the exact conduct they accuse Cedeño of time after time. So, I mean, the charges are bogus. The one attempt they had at a trial, it was very clear that Cedeño, even though he wasn't allowed to present evidence, he was only allowed to cross-examine, it was clear from that process he was going to be released. And so they stopped the trial on the last day and removed the judge.
It's a very serious
problem we have in his case and in other related political cases.
We're used to concepts of innocence until proven guilty, at least on paper, in the United States. I take it that does not obtain in this prosecution?
No, it's supposed to obtain, but it doesn't obtain.
Okay. So he was not able to put on witnesses in his own defense. He was only able to cross-examine, as you mentioned. So the trial was stopped. He was sent back into incarceration then?
That's right. He has not had a day of liberty in nearly 30 months.
Does Venezuelan law embrace concepts of reasonable bail and so forth?
Oh, yes. Absolutely. I mean, there's absolutely no legal basis for his incarceration. I mean, it's just an absurdity. And, you know, this man who's accused of this white-collar, fairly minor white-collar issue, is kept in jail while under Chavez, Caracas has become a virtual shooting gallery. Venezuela itself suffers 14,000 murders a year. It's just the whole thing is just completely absurd.
And so you are characterizing, and at this press conference tomorrow at the National Press Club in the winner's room there, you will obviously be characterizing Senor Cedeño as a political prisoner. How do you ground that? I mean, you've given us the background on the charges against him. Has he been an open agitator against the Chavez regime? What gives rise to the claim?
All right. Well, let's first definitionally let's make sure we're on the same page. A political prisoner is a prisoner who is incarcerated for purposes that are political. It does not mean that he has to be an espouser of certain political views. We know in this situation that the people around Chavez believe that he has assisted opponents of Chavez to escape, and we know that they believe he's funded the opposition.
Are not the nature of the charges against him.
Absolutely not. But that's the motivation. That's the improper motive for why he is in jail.
Okay, so for
and my colleague, who is actually going to be doing the press conference, I'm still in London.
Right.
My colleague has an open investigation against him for treason. He's a leading human rights advocate in Venezuela, and in an attempt, a blunt attempt to intimidate him, the Chavez regime some years ago opened up a treason investigation on both him and his partner so that they could essentially chill the waters surrounding human rights defenders.
So has he had to flee the country as well?
No, he continues, I think, very heroically to commute back and forth.
Anytime you face something like that, it is heroic. Is the prosecution against him being pressed?
Not now, but of course they have that open prosecution, so that it's that he never knows when he goes to sleep at night whether what time he'll be woken. It's a very intimidating thing to have hope.
Well, Bob, that was my next question. Namely, is what you're describing in Venezuela the sort of thing, for instance, that we are familiar in noting with the Pinochet regime in Chile, where people were disappeared in the night, some of the stuff that went on in Argentina? Is that the kind of system that is growing in Venezuela?
It's not there today, but I have to tell you, there are militia on the streets. They're called either the Tupamaros or La Pedrita or others that are left-wing hooligans with the latest rifles supplied by the office of the president. And the possibility, and I don't say it's happened because I don't believe it has, the possibility of that exists. What has happened, and I've written about it in the Washington Post, is Caracas, like Moscow, has become so lawless that opponents get murdered. And you don't know, the answer is you don't know who to blame. Journalists, lawyers, student leaders. I gave a speech to student leaders in Caracas, and I was told that three of the key leaders had been murdered in the prior 6 months. And there's no fingerprints, because in a country which is a shooting gallery, it's very hard to pin a murder on anyone in particular.
This is a disturbing portrait that you're painting, Bob.
I can just say so that we're clear. This isn't my portrait.
I'm not suggesting that. I'm taking this as reportage.
Yes.
Why is more of this not being heard? Is there that much of a media lockdown in Venezuela? What happens to journalists who go there to try to report?
Listen, there's a series of things. One, every time you talk about Chavez, people want to say he's a Democrat. He has elections. The fact that these are phony elections doesn't seem to matter to a lot of people. That's number one. Number two, there is a lot of reporting out of Venezuela. We don't read a lot of it. I think one of the things about the United States reporting over the last 8 years has been its tremendous continued focus on first Iraq, then the economic collapse. And, I'm always shocked. I live over in Europe. I'm always shocked by the lack of international coverage. And quite frankly, we are living in dangerous times, and the relationship Chavez has with Iran and the very serious nature with which Iran is pushing into Latin America is something that I think is a matter of, wherever you are on the political spectrum in the United States, it's a massive security issue. There's these direct flights from Tehran to Caracas every week. They're not monitored. There's this incredible anti-Semitism in Caracas that I've seen, that I had never thought in my lifetime I would see, let alone in a country that's so proximate to the United States.
Is there a substantial Jewish population in Venezuela, or has there been up until the Chavez regime?
Well, over 50% of the Jews have left. There is not substantial. It was 30,000. Now it's under 15,000. But there is just an incredible level of anti-Semitism that the white paper has a whole list of events and things that have gone on outside of the attack on the synagogue. There's a very common use of anti-Semitic slurs on national television. It's a pretty serious phenomenon, partly sponsored by Chavez, who is probably in the world today one of the most anti-Semitic leaders that exist. I would have to say to you that in terms of Judaism, Ahmadinejad in Iran is far more respectful than Hugo Chavez.
Where does that come from, Bob? I mean, is there a history of it?
He was personally very influenced by a specific anti-Semitic Peronist who influenced him as a fairly young man. It's very personal to him. It did not really exist in any level in Venezuela. It's It's part of the Chavismo, and of course, as you know, in the last number of years, it's been part of the more radical leftist narrative. The anti-Israeli stuff has really, in some places, morphed into some serious anti-Semitism.
Well, I'm not one of those that holds that criticizing the state of Israel necessarily constitutes anti-Semitism. But by the same token, if you're telling me that there are the broadcast media in Venezuela engages in overt anti-Semitic slurs that are obviously recognizable as such, then one has to at least inquire as to the institutional nature of something like that, because you and I both know there are various and sundry levels of racism, one of which is institutional racism, and that seems to be a manifestation of it. Of course, countries founded under the Empire of Spain have a long history of anti-Semitism. You think about things like the Conversos and such as that, and you know that undercurrent is there. Is what you're seeing in Venezuela worse than what one would expect in any other country of Spain's patrimony?
Oh yeah, no, I have this blog both on Russia and Venezuela, and if you go on my Venezuelan blog, you'll see an interview with a young Jewish student who was the Chavistas do this thing called a hack and tap. They did it to him. They did it to me. If you're somebody they think of as an opponent, they have technology that allows them to intercept your private phone calls. And unlike the Russians, who, when they intercept your private phone calls, keep it to themselves, in Chavez's Venezuela, they play these conversations on national television. So you can actually, there's an interview with a student leader that we interviewed in Caracas who talked about, you know, he's, I think, 19 years old, a Jewish boy, and the announcer plays his private conversation and then talks about, you know, he's a Jew, is he really a Venezuelan, identifies him. I mean, you can imagine the trauma this boy suffered, not knowing, you know, whether he was safe to go out in the street. Hugo Chavez, when I was there a few months ago, was facing a student protest, and he said, you know, we'll gas the students with good gas. I mean, I hadn't seen that in Putin's Russia, a leader of a country using the terms good gas to describe gassing his own students. There's some pretty strange stuff going on in Caracas.
So, as you, Bob, as you raise awareness of these issues and these events, what remedy do you prescribe?
Look, one of the remedies that I'm certainly going to be lobbying for is that the United States, as well as the European Union, adopt a law on the rule of law, and that law would state that for companies, state companies, to make acquisitions in the United States, the United States can certify that a country does not adhere to the rule of law, and their state companies cannot make acquisitions in the United States. You know, it's interesting, but that would have a tremendous punitive value against countries in respect to which the U.S. government often says they're powerless. The U.S. government actually has a tremendous amount of extraterritorial power that they will use at the drop of a hat. They need to make rule of law one of those fundamental issues. It is a huge security risk. Lawlessness, the kind of rampant lawlessness we see in Chavez's Venezuela, or for that matter, Putin's Russia, impacts American business. It makes American business non-competitive. It drives foreign and American companies to the lowest common denominator of corruption and lawlessness. And it's depriving these state-owned enterprises of the ability to access one of the world's major markets. If they don't adhere to the rule of law, in my view, is exactly the kind of thing we need to get some control. Because the truth of the matter is, Hugo Chavez in looking to China as he is, and then looking to Russia and Iran, is desperately trying to steer clear of U.S. control. The problem is, we're the main purchaser of his oil. And, you know, the faster we get some energy independence, the better. But I think focusing on rule of law and focusing on the obscenity that is Chavista justice today is a start, and that's why we're having this press conference. That's why we released the white paper. And we are hoping that we will get some traction in terms of trying to free these political prisoners.
Well, please convey my best hopes to your colleagues in Washington, D.C. for tomorrow. And I hope we can hear back from you about the outcome of that. And frankly, Bob, given your long experience in human rights, I'd like to have another conversation with you at some point in the future about some of the other countries that you have mentioned, China most particularly. I've been following the crackdown on the Uyghurs lately, and it somehow doesn't jibe with what I understand the United States should be in terms of how we feel about human rights. And I wonder to what, just exactly how much damage did the last 8 years of the Bush administration do us in our ability to talk about human rights around the country? And I hope we can have that conversation soon.
I look forward to it. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you, Bob. And again, our best regards to your colleagues in Washington.
Thank you so much.
Bye. Have a good evening. Bye now. Live from London, that is human rights lawyer Bob Amsterdam. One struggles to get an honest assessment anywhere of the status of human rights, of the status of you know, and that encompasses what it means to be human in its own right. Whether it be Venezuela, Russia, or yes, the United States of America. And that's what makes legitimate journalism so damned important. And frankly, I am no blind backer of any government. And frankly, it didn't bear mentioning in the conversation with Bob Amsterdam. But the fact of the matter is, I have friends in Venezuela. And as Hugo Chavez was rising to power, and these are members of the middle class, as Hugo Chavez was rising to power, they were all very excited. And I have friends here, dear friends, who would travel to see them. I've never been there myself. Wouldn't mind to go someday. A lot of places I want to go. But they would travel to Venezuela and talk about profound and positive change taking place. Essential services being provided that had not been provided before. Educational reform. Reform for the poor people. But then the coup did come. And it is possible, as Bob Amsterdam says, that that was a transformative experience for Hugo Chavez. For whom among us would it not be? And while Bob says some suspect that the CIA was involved, I don't suspect. I'm absolutely, given the last 8 years and the conduct of Richard B. Dick Big Time Cheney, I'm certain of it. But if Venezuela, under Hugo Chavez, is denying fundamental jurisprudential and legal rights to its citizens, then that needs to be addressed. I will suggest to you, however, that we need to get our own house in order first. It was last night when our friend Sandra mentioned that the Attorney General of the United States, as I've noted on this program, Eric Holder, that the Attorney General of the United States has a history that involved defending Chiquita Banana Corporation, in that corporation's admission, open admission, that they had sponsored the murder of labor organizers in Venezuela's neighbor, Colombia. And one wonders whether or not that was an essential part of Mr. Holder's character or simply another day on the job. I would like to see, as Bob notes, I would like to see the rule of law be expanded and included in how we treat our trading partners. I'll be honest, Venezuela would not top my list, China would. China is one great big boiling cauldron of human rights abuse. The same goes on, yes, in Russia. But you know what? Something else came to mind. When Bob was talking about what constitutes a political prisoner, a prisoner held not necessarily because of their political beliefs, but held for political purposes. In other words, the imprisoning of an individual for reasons that have to do with political expediency. You know who I thought of? And I know, you're going to say that, Bob, you're crazy. I thought of Leonard Peltier. I talked to you back when the rally at Marsh Fork took place. I told you about the stirring words of my friend Matt Sherman, who does work inside the federal prison system with American Indian inmates trying to better their lives toward the day when they return to society. And anytime I see Matt, I always ask him how Leonard's doing. Because, you know, even South Africa got around to releasing Nelson Mandela. The United States, through the presidencies of Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford, Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and now Barack Obama, have thought it just fine to let Leonard Peltier continue to rot in the federal prison system when everything around his conviction was suspect and remains suspect to this day. And within the definition that Bob Amsterdam gave, Leonard Peltier is without a doubt, beyond a shadow of a doubt, a political prisoner. Because each of those presidents, my God, George W. Bush commuted the sentences and pardoned people who had rock solid, and, you know, so did Bill Clinton, and so did Pappy Bush, and so did Reagan. People who had rock solid convictions for serious drug crimes. You know, we're not talking about possession of a gram of coke. We're talking about dealing the stuff. We're talking about financial crimes related. All manner of criminal conduct. Mark Rich under Bill Clinton. I've explained to you why I despise Mark Rich. It has nothing to do with the IRS. It has to do with what he did to working people, working families that I knew in the west central part of West Virginia when he spat on them during the labor dispute at Ravenswood Aluminum. hundreds of people have been freed by various and sundry presidents, Democrat and Republican alike. On each and every occasion, Leonard Peltier has been passed over and left behind bars, quite possibly for a crime that he did not commit. Leonard Peltier is a political prisoner in the United States of America, where we're not supposed to have those, you know. Leonard Peltier is a political prisoner because each and every president who has seen fit to leave him continue to rot has done so because they fear the outcry, because it involved the shooting of an FBI agent. Who shot the FBI agent? Dead! Even the evidence against Leonard Peltier was not conclusive. But each president has had to deal with the fact, that it was easier to leave him rot in prison than to face the cries of, "You're letting out a criminal. We gotta have law and order in America." And God knows, if it had been Bill Clinton letting Leonard Peltier out of prison, there probably would have been another impeachment hearing. I think it goes without saying that Barack Obama will exhibit no other mercy, no more mercy to Leonard Peltier than has been exhibited by his predecessors in office. No. So, yes, I am all for law and order. I am all for enhancing the role that human rights play in our trade calculations. Because absent that, American business is just another, you know, it's just another moment with that line from The Godfather. Tell Michael I always liked him. It was only business. Bob Amsterdam is correct. There is a great deal wrong in this world. And there is a great deal of work to be done. And if Senor Cedeno is a victim of injustice, he should be freed. Because if a government cannot withstand the light of day, and the light of fair inquiry, that government should not stand. And I make that statement across the board. And I don't limit it to the government in Venezuela or in Cuba or in China or Iran or Tel Aviv, but to the whole globe. And that includes us, the U.S. So that's our first hour. Chime in if you wish. Your thoughts are welcome on any and all topics. That's the nature of conversation radio. This is activist radio. This is The Horn. Green News Report with Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen up next. And then the second hour. We'll be back.
The way I always do. How was I? living in Havana. I took a little risk. Send lawyers, funds, and money. Dad, get me out of this. In a hard place.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
It's Tuesday, July 14, 2009.
Bush gets smacked down on smog. Texans told to conserve.
Oh, that'll happen.
Naked and recycled. Plus, 50th anniversary meltdown, our first and worst.
Yeah, real bad. All of that straight ahead. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this is your Green News Report.
Oh, it's too hot, lady. Gotta run for shelter. Gotta run for shade.
Okay, it's getting hot out there, but it got hot 50 years ago.
We'll get to that.
No one knew about it. Desi Doyen, what do you have for us?
A federal appeals court has overturned a Bush administration smog rule change that allowed power plants and factories to avoid installing new pollution controls. The rule change allowed industries to measure their average pollution over an entire region instead of locally, and then allowed those companies to buy pollution credits from other facilities, often hundreds of miles away, even if they had been closed decades ago. The District of Columbia Court of Appeals said that rule was inconsistent with the Clean Air Act because industries could continue or even increase pollution at individual facilities and didn't do anything to clean up the air in communities near power plants. The court's reversal will also likely make it more difficult for coal-fired power plants to be built in cities that already suffer from poor air quality.
Any word on whether they're going to go to the Supreme Court with that?
They have not decided yet whether they're going to appeal the decision.
Okay. Well, if they do, I bet they'll get a friendly decision from the Supreme Court.
The city of Los Angeles announced on July 2nd that it would phase out use of all coal-based electricity by 2020. That has now led to a Utah power company to abandon its plans to expand its coal-fired power plant in western Utah. About 40% of LA's power is generated outside the state, and the city is the biggest customer for Intermountain Power Agency of Utah. And this is a growing trend across the country. According to GreenBiz.com, the Sierra Club says that about 100 coal power plants projects have been scuttled in the face of increasingly strict pollution laws.
So it's good news to not have the coal burning plants, but well, we have enough power here in Los Angeles.
Yes, they'll just replace it with power from other sources like natural gas or solar.
Gotcha.
Food companies Naked Juice and Earthbound Organics are switching to 100% post-consumer recycled packaging for most of their products. According to GreenBiz.com, Earthbound Organics has already made the switch with 100% of its product line using 100% post-consumer recycled plastic. Naked Juice is beginning the process this month and plans to have all of its plastic packaging be 100% recycled by 2010. By switching to post-consumer recycled plastic sources, Naked Juice estimates over 8 million pounds of new plastic won't be manufactured.
And can all beverage companies do this? Can they all move to this type of recycled plastic?
Well, Naked Juice believes it is possible. Coca-Cola, for example, uses less than 4% recycled materials and apparently is struggling to reach a 10% recycled.
Really?
Yes.
And they could go up to, if they wanted to.
Naked is going up to 100%, but they use all plastic packaging, whereas aluminum can companies may have a different issue when it comes to that.
I see.
The state of Texas is asking its residents to conserve electricity as an early heat wave has led to record-breaking electricity usage across the state.
We can't conserve our way out of this crisis. Isn't that what Dick Cheney told us? He's not going to get people in Texas to conserve their way out of this crisis. I know people from Texas. You're from Texas.
Yes, in California, we managed to reduce our electricity consumption 12% during the Enron crisis. So we do know that it is possible.
Okay, so is Texas going to be able to conserve their way out of this crisis?
The Texas Public Utility Commission has issued
Question. Can Texas conserve their way out of this crisis?
The Texas Public Utility Commission has issued a set of guidelines for telling people to reduce their personal energy use and how to do it between the peak hours of 3 to 7 p.m. But seriously, it doesn't look like the message is getting through because, of course, it spiked to that all-time record last week.
You see, Texans aren't going to do it.
Several bills that would have benefited renewable energy projects in the state failed at the last minute in the legislative session in Texas that ended last month, including a solar energy incentive bill that failed by one vote.
That got killed. Don't mess with Texas.
It's the 50th anniversary of the nation's first ever nuclear meltdown accident.
Everybody was thinking, how can we repair the reactor? It was and save it and still have our jobs and not just say it's over with.
That was John Pace, who was a 20-year-old trainee at the reactor at the time of the accident. In 1959, the reactor at what is now known as the Santa Susana Field Laboratory in the San Fernando Valley experienced a partial reactor meltdown and released radioactive gases into the atmosphere. The lab was 28 miles from downtown Los Angeles, but only a mile from a residential
subdivision. This is amazing. You told me about this yesterday. You said 50th anniversary, and I thought, Three Mile Island, what was... Never heard of this accident.
That's
50
true.
Years ago today.
Pace was sworn to secrecy, and the partial meltdown was kept secret until 1979, when a UCLA film student discovered internal documents showing that radioactive gases, estimated at 300 times more than the infamous accident at Three Mile Island in 1979, had been released for at least 2 weeks after the incident.
And it has been kept secret, and it has still not been cleaned up to this day, correct?
That's correct.
They're still fighting
the Boeing and NASA money. Now own the lab for Field, the entire area, and in a ceremony to commemorate the 50th anniversary of our first ever meltdown, the EPA announced $40 million in stimulus funds will be spent on a comprehensive radioactive survey of the site, and the state of California has mandated a cleanup and decontamination of the site, which should be completed by 2017, nearly 60 years later.
And people around the site have problems with cancer and everything else. Read about that and much more at our website, greennews.bradblog.com. Unbelievable. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your radioactive Green News Report.
Are you ready for that great atomic power? Will you rise and meet your savior in the air? We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance, and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head-on with Bob Kincaid.
Minutes past 7 p.m. here on the East Coast, and we cruise into hour number two. A little update. I got this from David in Tennessee during the course of our conversation with Bob Amsterdam. An op-ed piece from Andres Oppenheimer from the Miami Herald. Apparently, just to let you know a little bit more of what is going on in Venezuela, there were mayoral elections in Venezuela's capital city and its largest city, Caracas. And in those mayoral elections, a man by the name of Antonio Ledezma was elected by a landslide, you know, sort of too far out there to even holler election fraud. He was elected by a landslide in November 2008. He is also a member of the opposition to Hugo Chavez. Chavez then did an end run on Ledezma and created out of thin air a super mayor of Caracas, gave one of his cronies the job, and stripped Ledezma of his offices as well as the vast majority of his budget. Ledezma engaged in a 6-day hunger strike to try to draw attention to his case, and also queried why it is that the Organization of American States justifiably was concerned about the coup in Honduras, but not justified, but not as concerned about the rather ham-fisted tactic that had been used to remove him from office. So all is not as it seems. And it is not unusual that people given the power of law and the power of government will frequently abuse it. Damn shame. Let's go to the phones. You know the number, 877-443-2366. 877, the numeral 4, head on, H-E-A-D-O-N. Email comes into Bob Kincaid, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D, at gmail.com. Learn it, know it, use it, wear it out. Let me know what you're thinking one way or the other. Hey, welcome to the program.
Well, I just had to speak on this, what Bob was saying. I find it very peculiar that we talk about Venezuela and Russia in the fashion that we do when we know the most, and I hope he's listening, when we know the most egregious offender in this world is the United States. And I think it takes the eye off the ball. And I can't help but think this fixation on all of these other countries it really does put us in this category, like, who are we to talk? And that's all I could think of when I kept hearing Mr. Amsterdam talk about Venezuela. Venezuela. I kept thinking, assassination squads, really? Well, you know.
Yeah, we do those.
Yeah, we do that. We do that, you know? And I just want to read something very briefly. I read off a comment off Rebel Reports about the assassination squads and just his take on it. It's by a guy named David, surprisingly enough, not me. Maybe it's another well, we know it's another David. Maybe it's David from Head On. I don't know. Maybe it's a David from the parallel universe. We don't know. The rule of law, we are told, that this is what binds us together as a civilized and just society. Without the rule of law, we are just animals operating under the law of the jungle, where might makes right. So when the United States, that beacon of freedom and democracy, trains death squads to go into sovereign nations and kills with impunity, where is our justification then? When Obama states that some Guantanamo detainee will need to be detained forever without even a fraud of a trial, in all probability without them ever committing any crime, where is our holy rule of law then? How does a man hold another man prisoner forever and then have the audacity to give speeches about freedom? This isn't about Bush or Cheney or Obama. It's not even about the Congress, who doesn't know only because it doesn't want to know, or even about a corrupt, soulless media looking only to sell more advertising. It's about us. We the people of the United States who have grown so gluttonous, immoral, and arrogant that we stand for nothing but consumption. We are like some sort of hillbillies who inherited the fine china of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, which we take out on special occasion to prove we have class, even though we have long forgotten, if we ever really knew, what the words on the parchment mean. Then there is our esteemed host, Jeremy Scahill, who spends his life writing articles and speaking of the evils perpetrated by the empire, but won't denounce the empire. I guess it's a liberal thing. The American empire isn't evil. It just does evil things. People, if I can't even get the likes of Mr. Scahill to acknowledge that in the war on terror, the United States is on the side of evil, then what is left to salvage in this great democratic experiment? And then Pablo says something about the hillbillies comment that I think you'll get a kick out of. He says, watch what you say about hillbillies. Your urbane dismissal of rural folk alienates the likes of Woody Guthrie, who are well aware of what's more often than not, otherwise your indictment has the ring of truth.
Yeah, I caught the hillbilly comment, too. I'm sensitive to that stuff.
Yeah, I understand. So, I mean, when I hear stuff like this, it makes me start to think, and I'm sure it makes you start to think, and I'm sure it makes the Horn listeners start to think, and then I think of an instance like what's happening with the David Kelly case. I'm sure you're aware of the evidence of coming in on that one. All 13 doctors say, no, he didn't kill himself. And then you just start to wonder. You say, if someone says that they never got an assassination squad off the ground, do you believe them, Bob? Do you? I don't.
Not for an instant.
Exactly.
And see, and you know, this is, you know, if there's one thing that can be said about this program is that we do not blindly cheerlead. Okay.
Yeah.
I've been plenty hard on Nancy Pelosi.
Uh huh.
But the fact of the matter is, do you remember the right wing outrage when she said the CIA has been lying to us?
Oh yeah.
How dare she? Oh, she's un-American. It turns out she was right, wasn't she? The CIA had been lying to the Congress. Only I don't see any great big mea culpas out there for the flying venom vitriol that was turned against her when she had the guts to come out and say they're a bunch of dirty damn liars. So, you know, if nothing else, credit where credit is due. Nancy Pelosi got it on that one.
Well, we'll see if she stays on that. I bet you she has totally changed her tune by the end of this summer. To me, the CIA, it also puts like a kind of like a Frank Luntzian spin on it, where you say the CIA was indeed thinking of having an assassination squad program. Oh, really? Well, to me, the whole organization, even if they don't have guns in their hands, assassinates people just by their policies and operations.
Yeah, hello.
So, I mean, again, is it I think we're here. This is another case of people are afraid to admit what we really are underneath the surface. They hate that. The same way when people confront someone in the financial world, and they immediately say, "I came up with this analogy." It is like when you confront someone in the financial world about, well, it does appear that there could be some rigging. There could be some rigging involved in the financial sectors. To me, what strikes me is they always come back with, well, I believe since you're not very since you're not intelligently informed about the financial world, that you don't understand the financial instruments. And to me, it's the same way how Scientologists say, well, you can't possibly understand the e-audit meter. So, I mean, again, we're dealing with something that is, this distortion that we want to create for all of ourselves, and we just don't want to see what's there because it's just too painful. And I wonder what is going to happen with the Obama administration, with the war on Afghanistan. I've been reading about the hospitals getting filled with soldiers already, and that's to be expected. It is quite interesting. I'm wondering when it is we'll go get around to talking about the problems we face in Afghanistan, because before you know it, we're already at a 5-year mark, and then we're talking about why were we there, and then we get the whole narrative that we shouldn't be getting, which is we're there for the war on terror. And again, see, when I was listening to Robert talk about Venezuela, I understand that he's really upset about some militiamen on the street, but I don't know. It is kind of, it is surreal, Bob, when you think about that. And you wonder if the same people who are so against Venezuela or so hawkish against Venezuela and Iran, are they hawkish and, against the secret militaries, the private militaries like Blackwater, Canopy? Are they hawkish against them? Because I see that as a thuggish militia force on the ground as well.
Well, and that's the point. You know, George Bush and Hugo Chavez served as a sort of bete noire for each other.
Right.
And of course the right wing never gives up in this country. And you know, Barack Obama, you see him, he shook his hand. He shook Chavez's hand. Oh, that means he's a communist.
Yeah, that's definitely something.
But you're right. Yeah. You're right. I mean, look, there was a thing about human rights I saw the other day where we had issued some statement thereupon, and governments around the world said, oh, yeah, the United States is chastising on human rights. That's a good one. Tell another one. Yeah, they torture people.
And that's what I mean. It distracts you from the most egregious example, and it happens time and time again, and I wonder, I really do wonder, and I started thinking about it, and I understand why people don't go that length, who are journalists, who are lawyers, like Robert Amsterdam, and I understand why the people don't, because the brand, the branding iron will come out, Bob, and it's that branding of anti-American, but we all know it, so there's a disconnect here. If Bob is still listening, we all know it. We all know the most egregious example, Mr. Amsterdam. We know that it is the United States. It's pretty much all aware all around the world now because of the internet. If they weren't aware before now.
Hey, let me run a moment of sublime paranoia past you, because I am capable of those, David.
Yeah.
Let's just work through this real quick.
Okay.
Our standing in terms of human rights in this country was severely damaged during the 8 years of the Bush administration. That goes
right
without saying. And, yeah, we are laughed at now when we talk about human rights because of the fact that we torture people, we detain them indefinitely. Our CIA does the death squad things. You know, all the things that we used to criticize heavy-handed dictatorships for doing.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be when we, okay, this is going back a ways, but do you remember when Jimmy Carter forbade the United States to participate in the Moscow Olympics
mm-hmm.
because of Afghanistan?
Okay.
The right wing had a fit. Absolutely had a fit about it. And there was a lot of and Jimmy Carter just said, look, you know, we're either for human rights or we're not. And the human rights of the people in Afghanistan are being trounced by the Soviet Union. And they're hosting the games, and they're in Afghanistan, and we ain't going to the games. And see, that really, really hurt, because that's a whole lot of American money that was coming into the Soviet system at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, but because we had a human rights stance, it was sort of the right and moral thing to do. Well, if you don't want to ever have those kinds of ugly little things getting in the way of making money, like, say, for instance, human rights violations in China getting in the way of most favored nation trading status, what's the best way to keep human rights from ever being an issue? Well, how about trashing your own country's human rights record so that you're no better than the rest of anybody else? Voila, problem solved. Let's all do business. And it doesn't matter if there's a 9-year-old girl at the bottom of the production chain, chained to a damn table in a sweatshop somewhere, breathing glue fumes for 13 hours a day. Right?
It's an extension of...
It's only business.
It's an extension of Naomi Klein's disaster capitalism, disaster ethics. I completely agree with you on that. I think that's exactly what is happening. And I also think there's something else happening that I'm clearly seeing as evidence of these pieces of criticism that come out now that we seem to criticize other foreign countries so willingly. I'm really convinced now that anti-American really does equate now, or it's beginning to even equate even more as we go on with this war on terror. It is equating more with being critical. You will not say the United States is an egregious example as a culprit in the world for genocide and et cetera. The violence and excursions like that, and you know that brings the interesting point up. So, really, what are we left with? We're left with just jumping and darting around from scapegoat to scapegoat, never exactly confronting us as a people and a nation. Because if that's the case, and it looks like that's going to be the case, and it looks like that's the case, it's the case with Obama's administration. Wow, talk about troubling times.
Indeed. And the question then is, how do we put that house in order? You know, it's as long as there's a right wing out there, and as long as they are as poisonous as what they are, David. That's always going to be the first question. How do we put this in order? Whether it's health care, whether it's the international warfare, human rights, the economic or environmental or social justice here at home, how do we deal with the right wing? For instance, the death squads. You know, Russ Feingold came out today. Our buddy Brad Friedman had an entry on the Brad blog.
Mm-hmm.
And it was clear, at least according to Brad Friedman, Senator Feingold said the Central Intelligence Agency withheld information about a secret counterterrorism program from Congress for 8 years on direct orders from former Vice President Dick Cheney, according to CIA Director Leon Panetta. And Senator Russ Feingold issued a statement saying the failure to, failure to notify the congressional intelligence committees to the program prior to last month was a violation of the National Security Act, and individuals who ordered that Congress be kept in the dark should be held accountable. I also have deep concerns about the program itself and have conveyed those concerns along with a request for a thorough investigation in a classified letter to the president. Feingold sits on the Senate Intelligence Committee. He's one of those people who was directly lied to. Okay. Now, but on the other hand, how's the right wing respond? What? What? You're saying you didn't want to kill Al-Qaeda? Yeah, you're not much of an American, are you? No, no, but they have the immediate, rapid responsibility, David, to recast something into what it's not. No, what we're saying is that the United States government, the people of the United States, via the government, via the Central Intelligence Agency, should not be in the death squad business.
Exactly. And
but the right wing gets it out onto, how do they, well, you know, the Democrats may, the liberals, they may be in favor of letting Al-Qaeda stay alive. And boom, you're done.
Which marches us even more. That's what marches us more to the right.
Sure it does. I mean, I last night on the program I mentioned the magnificent World War II propaganda series, Why We Fight.
Right, exactly.
And our pal Cindy in Washington promptly found the link to it on YouTube, and sent it to me. And I sat down to watch it. And it was brilliant, as I had said it was. It was everything I remembered it to be. But there were lines in there that, my God, you could use them to describe the Bush administration as easily as you could use them to describe Hitler, Mussolini, or the Empire of Japan. Outlawing labor unions? Well, the Republican Party has damn near done that in this country.
Right.
Reducing legislative branches to mere shadows of themselves? Well, look at that. All George Bush had to do... If George Bush came out and said, I want a law that says everyone has to chew their toenails, the Republican Congress was more than happy to pass that law and then talk about how, well, it's about family values. Toenails and family values. Boom, done. The opening scenes of that film are so stirring because you've got to get. It was a film that was made for U.S. Military personnel, and then later was released to the general populace.
Right.
And early in the film, it's why are we fighting? Is it because of this? And it shows. Yeah, Pearl Harbor, then it shows the Blitz of London, then it shows the attack on Poland, Czechoslovakia, Russia, yada, yada, yada. No, it's because of this. And it shows a picture of the Constitution. And it says, and it's because of this. And it shows the Ten Commandments of Moses. And this. And it shows, lo and behold, a quote from, get this, it's 1942, David.
Mm-hmm.
It's 1942. And it shows a quote from the Quran. And it shows a quote from the Bible.
Yeah.
Or from the New Testament. And then it shows a quote from the Analects of Confucius. And I was just sitting there goggle-eyed. Because I thought, my God, if the right wing saw this, well, but then again, they think that Franklin Roosevelt was a communist.
Hmm.
Merciful God.
On the issue about the on the war on terror, it seems to me that it really is a cancerous issue because there really is nothing. Well, once you get into a conversation with someone who is very extremist or thinks violence is the answer or very militant in his ways. you go down that path, and then you realize that this issue is taking up so much time of other issues, and you realize you look at this person and you wonder how much of this person's potential is being drained away from this. And what I mean by that is all of the possibilities of this country that we could have, and we focus our attention on these issues, it almost seems to me that whether Democrat or Republican, it is intentional, and they do know that it really isn't that much of a threat to the United States, and there isn't that much we can do about it other than with law enforcement, and to continue to have policy after policy, it puts us in almost like a paralyzing state, and we're left with question marks. Why are we doing this when we look at the military and we look at the CIA and we look at other organizations who, to me, and if the NSA is listening, to me, they're like at least 100 times more dangerous than any terrorist faction out there. And it makes me wonder if this is a symptom of the madness that they're so afraid to tell us, the government is so afraid to tell us what's actually happening. They're so afraid of us getting stronger. They're so afraid of us getting smarter. Like the fear factory that they built, Bob,
mm-hmm.
turning on them as well.
I want something to turn on them, David. I want there to be some sort of a sea change in this country that makes this country realize that we are so much more than just the Walmart to the world. Or actually, we're the world's Walmart customers, basically.
You know, just to put a fine point on, I remember what Sandra brought up, that story with the Goldman Sachs. And I think this is something really important that's coming down the pike, that's something that it's something unconceivable and unfathomable what's coming down and facing us because of the fact that what Matt Taibbi was saying. I read an interview that Goldman Sachs stopped concentrating on long term, and they started concentrating on short term. And now when you look at the gains that they made in the past 3 months, $2.3 billion, you have all these investment firms wondering how did they do that. And it makes me wonder if these are the new Merlins of our days, or these are the
but
shamans.
You see, turning those short-term gains is actually contrary to what needs to. I'm not saying that we don't need gains, but
right.
People look what they did in 3 months.
I know.
And you know and boom, the bubble machine cranks up again.
I'm saying something more sinister. I'm saying that a lot of these firms and some of the blogs that I'm reading as well, a lot of these financial experts are saying there's something not right about this. How could they increase these much gains? And a lot of people are saying that they really overreached this time in terms of gains because everyone else is feeling the pain while Goldman Sachs isn't. And then you have that announcement of the source code being released on the Internet, or some kind of code. They're not really sure what it is. Some people say it's just some random access code, but it was released on the Internet to a server in Germany, and then there's a quote of one of the lawyers who said that that source code was actually some sensitive trading software, and this is something that's not out there. The lawyer said this is some in the trial he said this is some sensitive trading software issue that could affect the marketplaces the world marketplace as we know it. And then it was erased from Bloomberg after Zero Hedge, which is an awesome blog on financial news, after Zero Hedge disclosed it, and it was scrubbed after like a third update. And if you still go to like Bloomberg News, for some reason they still have it up there, on one of the extra links, they never really completely erased it, I guess. They were just lazy. But on the sixth update, they took it out. And it makes me wonder the fact that, you know how you talk about election irregularities? If we're talking about the same thing and there really is thefting software in stock markets, and this is how they did get their gains, they've just created a financial black hole that we can't close. Because they're going to keep wanting more and more, and they're going to keep wanting more in shorter terms. And this is the monster. This is what I don't understand. When you talk to people who are college educated, who graduate with 5 or 6 degrees, these people, Bob, will insult you, and they will tell you, normal rational people, Bob. But when it comes to the financial markets, they'll say, you don't understand the financial world. You don't understand, and it'll have
right, as if it's run by some sort of the arcane practitioners of dark arts.
Right, some art, and they'll say you don't understand the financial instruments. And to me, this is what I'm grateful that Matt Taibbi has done. We can't be scared of this anymore. We really do need to keep researching this, and we do need to keep talking about this, because I don't think a 2 to 3 month gain, their investors are going to want to see something better now. And this, to me, this enables, if they're cheating now, Bob, imagine what they'll be like next year. And how can we ignore it anymore? That's what I'm saying. If they don't want to disclose exactly how they do it, all of these investing firms are wondering, because it really is. People can call it a conspiracy.
David.
Yeah.
That's a trade secret.
Yeah, it's a trade secret, exactly. And then you have the people, you know, you have the people who you confront every day, who are in the financial business, who are in the financial sector, who continue to tout this to tout it like a cross, like it's their god, and you begin to think, it's like, how can you not understand that your infinite greed does not compute in a finite world? And it's so simple, but yet so many people, Bob, they just don't get it. They want to pretend in that fantasy. And here's the other fantasy about it. I remember I was listening to some woman on Air America named Terry Savage, and this guy was talking about how the banks, how they could have so much profit from gains. And he said, but the money isn't really there, right? And she said, no, the money isn't there. And he's like, I don't understand. He goes, so there's no possible way you can have that amount of money on the earth, right? And she was like, no. And she's like, so what if there's a crisis? What if there's a problem? And she's like, I swear to you, she said this, well, you know what? I understand what you're talking about, and this is a financial expert, for God's sake. But you got to have faith. You got to have faith.
And were you surprised at that? Are you surprised that that word has been accorded such sacred cow status, faith? But then again, you know, you see the, and I hate the way the reporting is done. You know, the Dow's up this, the Dow's down that, NASDAQ this, NASDAQ went down under, and they'll say, you know, on investors' fears that Ahmadinejad might wake up with a headache. And, you know, Greg Palast pointed this out, and he said, anybody, back when gas prices were going through the roof, he said, anybody who pays any attention at all notices that the gas prices are going up, because George Bush rattles his saber, then Ahmadinejad rattles his saber, and Israel rattles its saber, and the next thing you know, oh, look, another 15 cents per gallon. And the traders say, yay! You know, my God Almighty, the markets, you know, took that nosedive on the financial collapse, but you know what? All the time that scheming and stuff was going on, ExxonMobil wasn't declaring any losses. You know, there's a lot of, maybe it is an article of faith, David. Maybe there isn't any science behind it. Maybe it's all just manipulation of imaginary stuff. And then they hand the tangible results to the people who work for a living in the form of losses and hard times.
Well, that would explain why we can't take a look at any of these companies' financial records. They probably have not been keeping a great track of.
Well, among other things, if you want, you know, we talk, we need to make Iraq safe for democracy. Jesus, how about making American business safe for democracy, David? There's no democracy in America's boardrooms. Oh, you're a shareholder? Oh, goody. You get to vote for the guy they tell you you can vote for. It's not like you can just run. There's no democracy in American business. It's run. The public corporations are run for the benefit of a select few who do everything in their power to make sure that power is constantly consolidated.
I just read, before I go, I just read something troubling. I just read that Goldman Sachs had somehow reduced their tax rates from 34% to 1% with new loophole strategies. Now ask yourself, how do you exist in a society like that once that's a reality in this country?
I don't know.
It's perpetual. It's never ending. And it's the nightmare. It's the nightmare.
It's the nightmare that we can't wake up from.
It's the nightmare we can't. And just one more thing. They said that what Goldman Sachs is doing on the Zero Hedge, for those people who want to go, zerohedge.blogspot.com, they said that what Goldman Sachs is doing that people don't understand is it's creating that that culture and that pattern, but also it is creating what they call financial what they're calling financial black holes in the marketplace, where it has that chaos and that turbulence there. And they were talking about how China now you want to talk about a scary scenario. They're talking about how China is such admirers of Goldman Sachs. They try to follow and parrot what the American companies are doing. They say there's something similar going on with an equity bubble. And I was looking at some charts, and I was like, Jesus, I don't know that much about finance and economics, but I know this. That's a damn big bubble.
No kidding.
Well, Bob,
the whole thing's a bubble, David.
Well, Bob, I'm going to let you get to other callers, but I just wanted to share that with people. If you guys want to find out, I really do commend this blog. I think you'll learn something, and a lot of the insiders that come there, it's heavily trafficked by a lot of people from Goldman Sachs as well, who want to find out what's being said. They break a lot of stuff on the financial news, and there's a lot of critical thinkers on there. In fact, they actually developed a piece of software which was able to track who was trying to do a search engine on the source code, and it turned out that the Department of Homeland Security, a lot of investment firms from that Russian programmer who had put that up there. So, you know, they do have some smart cookies there, and they also have some highly astute, humorous-type people as well to help you on your journey. So check it out sometime. It's zerohedge.blogspot.com. And for everyone.
And is that Z-E-R-O hedge?
Yeah, Zero Hedge. It's one word altogether, zerohedge.blogspot.com. And for all the people who haven't called in, the number is 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. Call in now.
All right. Thanks, David. Take care.
All right. Later.
Bye now. Wow, what a wide-ranging conversation. Let's see who else is on the line, if they've stayed with me. Nope. Had a blinking light there, but... what he said. It's true. Chime in if you have something you want to add to the mix. It's pretty tasty profit numbers. Of course, you know, Sandra mentioned them last night, that they were on the way, that we'd be seeing them today. Cindy writes in and says, Wall Street, it's an octopus that sucks the lifeblood out of the productivity of our nation. The only better scam is the Roman Catholic Church. The church extorts their sheeple under threat of damnation. Wall Street, which is the vehicle of Goldman Sachs, extorts the nation under threat of national bankruptcy. Same thing, pay the vig or die. Of course, I don't isolate that to any particular sector denomination. That's the religion industry in general. You got to remember, back in the 90s it was. I was in school somewhere, I think. When I received word that the church in which I had been raised, which was most assuredly not Roman Catholic, they'd make sure you knew that, decided that there were no more poor people in the community where I lived, that there were no more people in need of food, shelter, or clothing, that there was no more money needing spent on, you know, witnessing, bringing others to Christ. How do I know they did that? Because they spent in excess of $20,000 to bring a convicted criminal into that church to tell them about what God wanted for them in their lives. That criminal's name was Oliver North. So, you know, let's, Bunko is Bunko. We were working day watch on the Bunko squad out at, God, Joe Friday. Book 'em. You just want to, yeah, book 'em. Bunko. It really is kind of how it works, isn't it? Just quickly, I mentioned this in the show post for today's blog. Just a sort of a diversion. One of those things that I ran across. Look, I for reasons known but to God, or dog, or the flying spaghetti monster, or whomever, or whatever, or not ever, I can't resist checking out CNN.com every day. I just do. And maybe it's because I was, you know, once upon a time when the organization was not just a shamefaced piece of for-profit media, that there were actually dedicated journalists working there. I worked there too, and was working on being one of those poorly paid dedicated journalists. So I cruise by CNN.com every day, and just in case you were worried here on the 14th day of July, 2009, the number three latest news story behind I had a lot of anger about one of the last remaining survivors of the Bataan Death March, and behind seven held in deaths of Florida couple, the number three story is investigator visits Jackson dermatologist office. Really? The confirmation hearings of Sonia Sotomayor can't top a visit to the Jackson dermatologist office. At least not in CNN world. Everybody laughed at them when Ted Turner started CNN, and the real journalists said, "Oh, the news channel on the cable? Well, that's chicken noodle news." And they were quickly made to eat those words, but now, and especially once Time Warner and AOL, "You've got news," got hold of it, it did fast revert to chicken noodle news. But anyway, I saw this little link, and I just had to look because, you know, I never cease to be amazed at the willingness of the for-profit media to try to keep the circus in town. This is an article by Christy Keck. That's Christy and Keck, each with a K. Christy Keck, headlined, Political Sex Scandals, a Nonpartisan Affair. Ha ha, see, they used affair in the headline. Ha ha, ain't that cute? And lo and behold, the damn thing began. Now, bear in mind, in the last couple of years, we did have a sex scandal that touched a Democrat, namely Elliot Spitzer, who flushed his own real ambitions and hopes and right down the toilet. Okay, that's one. This is the lead sentence to that article, Political Sex Scandals, a Nonpartisan Affair, wink, wink. If there's one thing Democrats and Republicans have in common, it's sex scandals. And then proceeds to quote Sally Quinn, the wife of former Washington Post executive editor Ben Bradley, saying, well, you know, that's just prurience. In response to a paragraph, no matter which party the philanderer belongs to, the public wants all the juicy details, as evidenced most recently by the public's fascination with South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford. Mark Sanford's Argentine travels. That's just prurience, said Sally Quinn, a longtime Washington journalist and columnist. She's married to former Washington Post executive editor Ben Bradley. Sex sells, and everybody's interested in sex. So when there's a sex scandal, it's got everything. You're talking about sex. You're talking about power. In a lot of cases, money is involved. You are talking about how the mighty have fallen, she said. B.S. And, of course, there's the obligatory mention of the affairs of John Kennedy. And the press never said a word about it. That was a different time, you know. Paul Slansky, author of the little quiz book of Big Political Sex Scandal. Oh, my God. I think what happened is that after Watergate, the press discovered that there was gold there to examine the politicians' lives. And then, okay, remember we got a bare mention of South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford in the second paragraph. And then it's straight to John Kennedy, then Wilbur Mills, and what? Oh, yep, there he is, Bill Clinton. Get this sentence, because you're just going to love it. In the decades since Mills' downfall, dozens of politicians have followed in his missteps in some cases, like that of Democratic President Bill Clinton and Republican Senator David Vitter of Louisiana. The guilty parties are able to overcome their dalliances. I'm going to say a dirty word. No, I'm not. I don't have to, because you're probably saying them for me. Yeah, that's right. Christy Keck just equated Bill Clinton, who had a consensual adult affair with a woman, not his wife, and she gave him oral sex. I mean, it is what it is. Christy Keck just equated that with a right-wing family values senator who repeatedly paid hookers. You know, as in broke the law. Yeah. And whose apparent kink, according to word that has spread through the prostitute community with which David Vitter was involved, involved some sort of infantilism. And as far as I'm concerned, anything that doesn't involve non-consenting farm animals or the dead, as long as both sides consent, fine. You want to be tied up and whipped with wet linguine? Both sides consenting? Do it. but the following day, do not stand up on the in the halls of Congress and talk about your God-blessed family values. That's the dividing line. No, Christy Keck, they are not all the same. I'm reminded of Big Jim Folsom, former governor of Alabama, who was asked by the press, and this may perhaps be apocryphal, but it is often told down south as truth. There was a sex scandal brewing about Big Jim Folsom, and they said, Big Jim, is it true you slept with that woman? And Big Jim responded, it's a damn lie. Didn't either one of us get a wink of sleep. It's not, this article willfully, I tender to you, willfully miscasts the nature of political sex scandals. Did Mark Sanford hike the Appalachian Trail with his Argentine soulmate? Apparently he did, by his own admission. Was he married to another woman at the same time? Speaks for itself. Now, to me, that means that it is a matter to be solved between those three individuals, and preferably between the man and the woman who happen to be married. Those are the people who have to really sort it out. And it is nobody's business but theirs. However, if, on the other hand, you have gone about braying about family values and the sanctity of marriage, then no, it's not your sex life that gets called into question. It is your obvious hypocrisy. Because how you have sex does not have a lot of bearing on how good, how qualified you are to represent the people of a district or a state or a nation. Hypocrisy, overt hypocrisy, however, does. Overt hypocrisy means that you cannot be counted on to vote your conscience or to represent the people of your district, state, or nation with any degree of consistency. Which means that you have debased the coin of your supporters' votes by making yourself incredible in your representation of them. Because they can never be sure, once you've been proven to be a hypocrite, they can never be sure that you are acting in their behalf or on behalf of your own hypocrisy. Makes sense to me, does it to you? We'll take a quick break, and we'll come back, and we will go to your phone calls if you want to make them. 877-443-2366. 877, the numeral 4, head on. Direct dial 304-658-3333 and email to bobkincaid@gmail.com. Short of those, you're going to have to do semaphore or smoke signals, okay? This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. We can always use the support. This is the horn.
Shh. She don't like her eggs all runny. She thinks crossing her legs is funny. She looks down her nose at money. She gets it on like the Easter Bunny. She's my baby, I'm her honey. I'm never gonna let her go.
He ain't got laid in a month of Sundays. Caught him once and he was sniffing my undies. He ain't too sharp, but he gets things done. Drinks his beer like it's oxygen. He's my baby, and I'm his honey. Never gonna let him go.
In spite of ourselves, we'll end up sitting on a rainbow. Against all odds, honey, we're the big door prize. We're gonna spike our noses right off of our faces. There won't be nothing but big old hearts dancing in our eyes. She thinks all my jokes are corny. Convict movies make her horny. She likes ketchup on her scrambled eggs. Swears like a sailor when she shaves her legs. She takes a licking and keeps on ticking. I'm never gonna let her go.
Got more balls than a big brass monkey. Swacked out weirdo and a love bug junkie. Sly as a fox, crazy as a loon. Payday comes and he's a-howling at the moon. He's my baby, I don't mean maybe. Never gonna let him go.
In spite of ourselves, we'll end up a-sitting on a rainbow. Against all odds, honey, we're the big door prize. We're gonna spike our noses right off of our faces. There won't be nothing but big old hearts dancing in our eyes. In spite of ourselves, we'll end up a-sitting on a rainbow. Against all odds, honey, we're the big door prize. But we're gonna spike our noses right off of our faces. There won't be nothing but big old hearts dancing in our eyes. There won't be nothing but big old hearts dancing in our eyes. In spite of ourselves.
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Bob.
9:30 past the hour, and why not? Let's go to the phones. For they are a-sitting there blinking at me. Okie doke. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, Juanita.
Well, that old song, I Could Cry Salty Tears. You know, I'm disgusted and I'm aggravated and I'm disappointed.
Yeah.
Frustrated, mostly. For one, about three different things about our situation. One is, of course, the war, or wars. Graham asked the lady if she believed we were at war. I didn't hear her answer because I've been having trouble with my computer, and I have to listen to that show on my computer. But anyway,
Lindsay Closet Case Graham asked Sonia Sotomayor if she believed we're at war.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't hear the answer, but...
I didn't either, but I know what the answer should be. What? The Constitution says only Congress can declare war. Did you guys declare war and I missed it?
Yeah, well, you know, I ain't gonna tell you what I did call him, but he reminds me of Himmler. He's a Hitler wannabe, but he ain't quite got what it takes. But he sure is arrogant. I just don't like that man. At all. But I'm frustrated. Another thing I'm frustrated about is all this stuff. I mean, why don't they go ahead and investigate, do what we the people want them to do? I guess they're just not going to do it. You know that thing about let's look for tomorrow, not yesterday or whatever? I'm tired of that.
Oh, you mean look forward and not back?
Yeah. Are we supposed to tell, somebody that had their child murdered? Just, you know, well, that's in the past. Just you, go forward. This is the same thing. It's in the same wavelength. And then another thing I'm frustrated about is wanting us to be patient about the recovery, or
yeah,
whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, because they didn't seem to be too patient when they were bombarding our email inboxes with pleas for donations for the campaign. They weren't very patient, were they?
Oh, well, they still are. They're still asking stuff for one thing or the other. And you know, I think I still don't understand why all that money was given to all those people. I heard a little bit of what David was saying, and I think he's spot on with what I heard. It's just maddening.
It is. It is maddening. And you want to, you just want to kick something, holler, scream, anything.
Yeah. And they're still on that Senate hearing, Senate decision. All those amendments on medical care. But I mean, why, Bob, tell me, why do they give them all that money, the banks and all of them? Why?
Well, because they were blackmailed into it.
Anything good?
They were blackmailed into it, Juanita. If you don't give us the money, we're going to ruin the whole American economy. It was a stick-up. It was a heist.
I still think, like a lot of people said, give us the money, we will spend it.
Yeah, you could have stimulated the economy a whole lot more just by giving the American people that money.
Right, right.
Because remember, it was all about being able to take out loans. You know, well, you know, business can't take out the loans that they need to meet payroll. Okay, take the money that you're going to give them that they're then not going to loan to American business and make payroll that way. And watch people go out and buy stuff and fix furnaces and put roofs on their houses and tires on their cars and reinvigorate the entire economic structure of Main Street America.
Right.
Sorry, no.
Well, no, I got like $250, and I'm glad I
didn't spend it all in one place, did you?
Huh?
Didn't spend it all in one place, did you?
It's better than nothing, but they could have done a lot better than that. And I have what they call a mobile home, which is not mobile, and you cannot get any kind of help of any kind to fix it up. I have to every spare penny I have, and I'm not complaining because I know plenty of other people are doing the same thing. Is what I have to put on this place, and I mean it's worth it to me. But you know, and then you never know when the county's going to get you like they did me before, and it really set me back because now I've still got things that needs to be done that I could have got done if they hadn't put me on a deadline. And you know, if they don't want to help me, I mean, I don't know what I'd have done if I hadn't had a child that would help me, because a lot of people don't have anybody.
No.
Not nobody.
And, you know, we heard we heard a lot of those stories of people don't have anybody to help them when our buddy Kate was on the Gulf Coast. There are lots and lots of people that don't have anyone out there.
Yeah, definitely.
And how they survive, I don't know. You know,
I don't either.
The one I did see, and I hope it was as positive as I think it was. I saw President Obama's appointment for Surgeon General.
Yeah.
And I looked at it and I said, I'll be damned, I think he got one right.
It sounds pretty good, doesn't it?
Because she's a woman who doctored folks down in Bayou LeBatre, Alabama.
Oh.
And she runs a clinic for poor people down there.
She
doctored folks all the way through Hurricane George and Hurricane Katrina and kept on doctoring.
I understand she makes house calls, too.
I read that as well.
Did you know her, Bob?
No, I don't know her or anything, but It just looks like it may be the right call.
Yeah, it really sounds good. Thank God they didn't get that other guy. But... from CNN.
Oh, Sanjay Gupta, please.
Yeah. But, I mean, Howard Dean would have been good, too.
Howard Dean would have been fine. But you know what?
He'd have been one.
I've decided Howard Dean needs to be senator from Vermont whenever Pat Leahy.
Oh, wouldn't that be wonderful?
Yeah.
Oh. The only thing good I saw last night on that Medicare thing, I mean, not Medicare, but the health care thing, is Bernie Sanders had an amendment. He just said, I don't really know exactly how to go about it, but he said we need to stop fraud. And he was talking about it wasn't just the small people doing fraud. It was he named it like Aetna and all. I mean, they've had to pay fines in the millions or billions or something. I forget now, but they passed that thing right away. Even the Republicans passed it.
Well, they can't be seen to be against wasting government dollars.
And of course,
even though they are, they just can't be seen to be there.
Your resident doctor, who's a member of what is it, Seventh House, Sixth House, House Seven? What's the name of that place?
Oh, what? You mean Tom Coburn?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, they just call it C Street.
Oh, C Street.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was his number.
No, they
but
just
anyway.
Yeah, the family.
Yeah, the family. Boy, I'll tell you, that thing is. I'm telling you, Bob. People, and see, you know, we've been saying that what they do is okay if we do anything halfway or even a tenth of what they do. We're horrible. And this absolutely proves, I think, that ordained of God, because they're special.
Look, it's Calvinism on acid. Okay, that they are God's special elect. It doesn't care if there's. It doesn't. God likes it when they sleep with their best friend wives. God likes it when their mommies and daddies write payoff checks. Because this virgin, and I've got to read this book, this version
God
of...
God loves the rich people better than he does...
That's
people.
Why they're rich.
Yeah.
It's the ultimate prosperity gospel.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, I wonder if some of those prosperity gospels are not in cahoots with them. More than likely, they are.
Wouldn't surprise me a dime's worth.
No, uh-uh. But really, Bob, I really, it's just sad all the way around. And, you know, I think about, now, I don't know how long I'll have to live. If I could live another 20 years, maybe. Who knows? But I'd like to see things get better before I die, maybe next year or whenever it's going to be. And not for myself only, because I would like to see other people reap the benefits. You know, I care about other people.
And that's why you got the right kind of soul, or, you know, whatever word we want to use for it.
I hope.
No, I'm pretty sure. I'm pretty sure.
But, you know, it, I mean, it's... And oh, I know another thing that you're hearing so much racism. More so now than any other time, I think. And you know, not just people calling into shows, but the, on the Fox, you know, like saying that Americans marry other species.
Yeah. Charming, isn't it?
And then they laugh about it, and they laugh about...
They laugh about drowning teenage boys, and this latest one that's... well, yeah, that was Pat Buchanan laughing about drowning.
Oh, talking about
Levi Johnston.
Her son-in-law that was going to be her son.
Yeah, her son-in-law that was never her son-in-law.
People put their faith in a woman like that. It's just as bad as Bush. Maybe in some ways worse.
Right. But and the, this latest thing, the guy that we reported on last night, Freedom's Youth or whatever the name of the sickening little group
the
is.
The one with all the tattoos?
No. This is the guy who wrote this Twitter thing about will Sonia Sotomayor shank Scalia on the court, and he retracted it this morning because he got a lot of hell for it. He said, I don't understand. It's just a joke. So let me fix it. I didn't mean to say that. I meant will Sonia Sotomayor kill Scalia in a drive-by?
Oh, that's better.
Yeah.
Well, what about, what's the difference in Pat Robertson asking for people to pray that the liberal...
not a dime's worth, or
that they would die, or
Mann Coulter, suggesting that someone put cyanide in Justice Stevens' creme brulee. Remember that?
Yeah.
But the thing is, murder is funny to the right wing. Check this out, Juanita. You'll be able to hear this. Just check this out for a second. This is a new TV ad by a gang of right-wing thugs by the name of Committee for Justice. And it's about Sonia Sotomayor. How's this for a smear?
Remember Barack Obama's buddy Bill Ayers, the unrepentant terrorist who bombed American buildings in the 70s? Turns out President Obama's done it again. Picked someone for the Supreme Court. Judge Sonia Sotomayor, who led a group supporting violent Puerto Rican terrorists. Is this radical judge the type of person America needs sitting on our highest court? What is he thinking? What was she thinking? Call your senators. Tell them to stop Sonia Sotomayor. Paid for by the Committee for Justice.
Isn't that fun? She supports Puerto Rican terrorists.
Well, you know, what is so sad to me is that the churches are so involved in all this. Look at the guy, and it's a Southern Baptist, praying for Obama to die. Give 5% of your prayer time to pray that Obama will die.
Yeah, that's that imprecatory prayer.
Oh, that's the one, huh?
Yep.
Well, oh, Bob, I'll tell you, and
I mean, you can just hear it, can't you, Juanita? Now I lay me down to sleep. God, won't you kill that communist creep?
Yeah.
Take Obama overnight and never let him darken my sight. Amen.
Well, it's just like it's been all through time, and especially in our country, is the people that really wanted to help. And like you were talking last night about the man in the film, the congressman from your state that helped people to get funds for black lung, you know. And those people were cheering him and mocking and making fun of him. And that's exactly what anybody that tries to help in the least little bit, they just want to get rid of them. And some of them they're not going to go along with the flow either. They think that they're in the in crowd, and they're not necessarily in the in crowd. They're going to be so surprised when they're rejected. by the people that they're slumming with. If you get my drift.
Yeah, I do indeed. I do.
And, it's just, I'd rather know that I'm not going to go with the flow than be surprised like that. But they're going to, there's plenty of them because there's not going to be room for a whole bunch of other people.
No, no. What's that? Broad is the way.
Uh-huh.
Is that what we're looking for here, Juanita?
Well, that could be. Yeah, that's part of it. Yeah.
And it leads to the lake of eternal fire that's reserved for the devil and his angels. Have I got that part right?
I think.
Yeah, I think so too.
But I've got that verse for you.
Oh yeah.
Just a minute, I'll find it if my computer will permit me.
Oh, I figured you had it memorized.
No. Sorry, Bob.
Oh, that's okay. Well, you're going to miss. Hey, look, we all drop a stitch now and then, Juanita. Don't sweat it.
Well, there's. I would say that I know more than a lot of people, but I know very little, let's put it that way, compared to what there is to know. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Yes,
this
it
is
does.
From James, the book of James 2. If a brother or sister be naked and destitute of daily food, and one of you say unto them, depart in peace, be ye warmed and filled, notwithstanding ye gave them not those things which are needful to the body, what does it profit? Even so, faith, if it hath not works, is dead, being alone. That book of James is not very long, and it has a lot of things it talks about. If someone comes and they're not dressed in finery, and you don't,
if there is a historical aspect of the book of James, it is that its author, whomever it was looking around and seeing the same old corrupting influences happening inside that movement that they had simply called the Way, where people were dressing up in their finery and showing off. Uh-huh. And lo and behold, he was sick of it.
And then
John Calvin comes along and completely throws the book of James. For all intents and purposes, Calvinism says the book of James and all that faith without works is dead business, just doesn't exist. Because God's mad at us, most of us. Some of us he's decided to be nice to before we were even born. The rest of us can just, mm-hmm. Take it and eat it and smile.
Every time you hear, you think you've heard all the perverted stuff you can hear, they come up with something else.
Oh, I know they do. Juanita, good talking to you, dear. I've got to run on. Got a couple of blinking lights that I hope haven't hung up on me yet.
Okay, you take care.
All right, you take care too, Juanita. We'll talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye now. And rolling along. Hey, welcome to the program.
Well, Gonzo effing greetings. What's going on?
Oh, Gonzo effing greetings, J. Spike Rogan.
That's all I can say when it turns out my county was paying
Nazis
to work at a prison.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks for sending me that, man. And then, by the way, you got kudos from our buddy Kate via email last night. She said, good on Spike for noticing the correlations.
Yeah. The local media overall, other than the local newspaper, is doing a little coverage on it with the few people who even work there anymore. And the local cables, the cable company's news broadcast, which is kind of almost like the Wayne's World of news.
News time, excellent. Yeah.
the mainstream TV media around here, they're paying very little. As a matter of fact, since he came back and they spotted the tattoos, they're afraid to show them. So basically, they're afraid to talk about them. So they're kind of sweeping. Now, I would understand if you don't want to give Nazis the attention because it would embolden them. But the bigger problem is there was a county that just paid. Like, it's an unavoidable issue at this point. You got to talk about it. You can't hide this one. You can't hide that you had a member of a skinhead organization. I mean, that's like having Osama bin Laden as warden. I mean, this really should be everywhere. This shouldn't be just a big local story. This should be a big national story.
Well, then there are still unanswered questions about that story, Spike. For instance, how did they not notice the swastika tattoo on his arm? Or the big tattoo that said Hitler in black bold letters? How did they not notice that?
I'm figuring he probably wore a long sleeve shirt for his interviews and all.
Yeah, with a turtleneck up to his chin.
Yeah. How they don't search for what tattoos that would be visible potentially at work, just for the simple fact that, you know, in the prison, dudes with different gangs get tattoos, and it's a language. It's a major form of communication. So even if someone just has a tattoo that maybe on the outside wouldn't mean something, wouldn't it make sense to check for that? I mean, what if some guy who's just he's just a Larry the Cable Guy fan, and he has, you know, some kind of redneck tattoo. He might be in for a rude awakening. He goes inside and he's accidentally showing, you know, the skinhead colors. You know, like, shouldn't you at least be looking at it from that aspect to make sure someone doesn't have one that accidentally get them stomped, for something they didn't realize it would cause? I mean, this guy, Hitler, the SS on his wrist, that was kind of...
Right, and that's my point. Was he wearing gloves too?
Because he had the fingers with the...
And the tribal geometric swastika kind of thing goes all the way up the back of his neck behind his ear?
Yeah, well, you know, what really annoys me about that is, for that one, he told them, because that one was shown in an interview, oh, it's a Celtic image. As someone who's extremely Irish and has the Harp Veron on my Phillies hat, you know, that was the Irish Brigade badge or pins for their hats in the Civil War.
Right.
That bothers me a lot, even more so now. Especially, actually, I'm half Irish, half German, so Nazis kind of really just kind of rubbed me the wrong way for two reasons, I guess.
You know, they rubbed millions of people the wrong way, Spike, but no.
Yeah. But, you know, sadly, and sadly, this only goes to further prove my point. I think the racism is worse in the North than it is in the South at this point. I think maybe the South had it for a long time.
Oh, still does. Still does.
I think the problem is the North is so much more ghettoized when you really think about it. I mean, certainly Alabama is pretty ghettoized though. But you know, you go to Virginia and some of your, you know, Maryland, places like that. Once you head just a little south of Mason-Dixon and hit those areas, it seems to be a much more mix of people, diversity-wise, than up north. Aside from in suburbia, you have a lot of Asians and Indians and Middle Easterners. It's otherwise fairly white, you know. And even in certain cities like Philadelphia, basically the black people live in West Philly, which is pretty dumpy. Once you get past the campus of the University of Pennsylvania and Ivy League, and then South Philly is where a lot of the Italians live. You know. You watch a Red Sox game. You know, how often do you really see non-white people at Fenway Park seeing a Red Sox game? I think, sadly, when we see what's going on, there's a lot more of the white supremacist movement going on in the North than maybe a lot of people in the North want to admit.
Well, in the South, you've got the Klan. I mean, you've got other organizations as well, but the Klan is quintessentially Southern. But you've got it, and I think when you say the North, you're talking about the Northeast, Spike, because you know, Lord knows, between the Mormons and the skinheads, they got Idaho locked down tight.
Yeah,
you know, we've got listeners who are good liberal human beings who live in Idaho, and I'm like, you know, guys, just you know, watch your, you know, where you live, right?
You know, my friend Patrick Morrow, he does sports talk. He used to do stuff on Peter B. Collins. He grew up out there, and he put on his bio, "I'm from Idaho, and I like potatoes, and no, I'm not a white supremacist." And someone wrote him an email complaining about that, but I'm guessing that really is a serious issue out in Idaho. I'm glad I won't be passing through there anytime soon. We had a crazy guy, or a crazy group, I should say, probably mostly men, in Berks County, Pennsylvania. They were along Interstate 78, and they had a big giant sign like God was going to condemn. And it started out with, like, gays and stuff. And then it, like, divulged into, like, Mexicans and, you know, the N-word. And they had a shortwave radio station they ran from there, because then they also had a big sign that...
Yeah, it'd be a lot easier just to have a big sign that says, God's going to get everybody but us.
Right. Yeah, it was like a long rambling sign of who God's going to get. I mean, several lines long, which when you're doing 65-70, you're going to pass that quicker than you can catch everyone they seem to be making statements on.
You ain't white, you're toast, you know.
Yeah. Well, I remember when I was in junior high, there was a kind of a big movement of the skinheads in this area, and then it kind of died down, but I guess it comes through sadly in ways. I just, this prison here, though, it's been out of control because, let's see, within a 2-year span, they had 4 wardens. They had about 3 years ago, they had a big scandal where a few female guards were having sex with some of the male prisoners. And then
I remember that one.
Drug trafficking.
Well, and isn't it also in Pennsylvania where the big scandal broke about judges who were essentially selling juvenile defendants into for-profit prisons? Wasn't that PA?
Oh, yeah, that was Luzerne County. Yeah, Luzerne County, which is Wilkes-Barre and Hazleton, where Lou Barletta, where he comes from. That's Luzerne County. They're kind of like the neighbors to the west of Monroe County, a little bit to the north part also, and. Yeah, that went on there, and the only thing that brought that down was a girl who they put away for something that really shouldn't have put her away for that long. When she got out, she called the judge's office and left him a voicemail threatening to kill him. So he reported it to the police, in which turn the police started to investigate, why did this girl just give a death threat? And when they started to look into what she did time for, they realized she really shouldn't have done the kind of time she had just done. And that's where it all started rolling downhill from there. So it actually took one of the kids who got screwed to come out and do something, which at the time the media made it sound like she was just a complete nut. And it was crazy. It took that girl to come out and actually just basically openly threaten to kill one of the judges for that, to finally cause the state police to start investigating. And that's where it all came down. And there's constant scandals in Luzerne County. The sheriff's department, I think in April, they found a bowl and some weed or something in someone's sheriff's car, and then now they found some cocaine in one. There's just constantly problems out in that part of the world, Pennsylvania and Luzerne County. So, and there's constantly ones here. Unfortunately, we have very little media coverage because we sit in kind of almost a black hole limbo area of media coverage. A lot of the transients here watch the New York media, so they don't even see the local media. We're just really kind of far to the north for the Philadelphia news, where unless it's something really big, they only...
And it's the Poconos, for God's sakes. It's a vacation destination. It's not a seedy hotbed of corruption. It's the Poconos.
Yeah, aside from the casino that the guy with mob ties had opened just not too long
ago. Well, we won't talk about that, but yeah.
Yeah, it would be amazing if there was actually scrutiny and coverage to what went on here. Things that would suddenly come to an end. And then the worst part is right now the Republican county commissioner is like the person propped up in charge of that prison, who clearly she has no idea of what's going on there, because when everything first started, she kind of played dumb and saying, well, he passed his background check. There was nothing strange about him that would lead us to believe something like this would happen, which then when he came back wearing a T-shirt, there were tons of signs and not a single person noticed it. And it's not like it's just it used to be one party rule here, but the county commissioner's office is pretty much evenly split between the two parties now.
But honest to God, backing up just for a minute, Spike, honest to God, let's say that there's a bunch of that having those, that ink would maybe get you a little bit of cooperation from a certain portion of the prison population. What about the other part of the prison population that is going to see that as a direct threat?
Oh, I know. And not to mention, who knows who he probably, I'm almost positive. I mean, just by, what are the odds he didn't beat a minority in there? I mean, if you bet on that, don't expect to ever see your money again. If he's a skinhead, forget about it. He's definitely trying to brutalize the minorities in there and screw with them and cause trouble, cause them to do more time, set them up for stuff. Oh, this is grade A BS, is what it is. It's just totally unacceptable. Not only does this deserve something like a worst person, or this deserves like national coverage of a protest calling for the local leaguers' heads over this. We can't have business as usual in Monroe County anymore. I'm embarrassed. This is the county I grew up in, not Northampton County where Easton is. I grew up here in Monroe County. It's just shameful. I mean, it makes me forget I live in the United States of America, 2009. You could fool me and think I'm living in the 1920s with baloney like this. I mean, it's just...
Yeah, but this stuff doesn't happen in a vacuum, Spike. The rise of this stuff has been deliberately facilitated by the right wing.
Yeah, and then most of the Democrats in charge here are pretty right wing as well. They're just, you know, in name difference. You know, when you really think about who our Democrats are here from.
You know, if the guy beats the murder rap, there's always the army for him. Because they just love to have people like him in their ranks.
Yeah, well,
gay guy with an IQ of 156 who can speak 19 languages, the army doesn't want him.
No,
but they're happy to have a skinhead with a tribal Celtic tattoos that spell hate.
And isn't it interesting as well that you get both the military and the prisons and stuff? Boy, they have some great screening processes to make sure potheads can't get the job. But they don't seem to have a way to figure out how to keep the skinheads out.
That's just funny. I mean, that's true. No, we can't have any of those dangerous dope smokers. Isn't there a skinhead out there we can hire?
And according to my cousin, who works in a state facility in the state of Florida, he says he very often, after his day's over, he cries from work because it's just a crazy world on both sides in there, he said, for a large part. And, you know, you see guys who are in there, you know, he said there's plenty of guys in that place that do belong in there, he says, but then you see the crazy stuff. Like, there's one guy in there where he works, and it was a drug deal gone bad. He ended up killing three people. But I guess since he ratted out someone or whatever, he got 10 years. Meanwhile, another guy's in there, and in like a span of 6 years, had three armed robberies, life in prison. And he says, you know, what's that telling our kids? That personal property is worth more than lives? You know, it's a terrible message. And then that's the other crazy part about our prison system is how people get to it, you know, and what people are doing time in there for it. not to mention here in Pennsylvania, it's also become the number one leader in mental health care at this point, since we don't have any other place to put a lot of people in most parts. So,
Jesus.
And which means the Monroe County facility might have some people.
When the Nazis had control of Europe, it was referred to as Fortress Europa. Welcome to Prison America.
Yeah.
Haven't broken a law yet? Just wait. You will. You won't even necessarily know. But there'll be some law and order type there waiting to throw the book at you. Hey, Spike, brother, I got to roll along. I got a couple more blinking lights I want to try to hit.
All right. Well, thanks for giving attention to that story. Not too many people have at this point.
Oh God, it should. It needs to get more attention. It really, really does. And frankly, it needs more investigating. You know, there needs to be a correlation, an investigation correlating the number of claims of prison beatings versus who did the beating.
Yeah.
Because you'll see that white power, that'll come bubbling to the surface like some sort of swamp ooze.
And hopefully they'll start having somebody who knows enough about tattoos in prisons to be around to tell them what is and isn't a dangerous sign they'll have on one of your officers.
I bet you they could get free service from the Southern Poverty Law Center and the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith. I bet they'd be happy to help.
Yeah, just unfortunately the people running the prison here are politicians with no business running a prison.
Well, I know. Take care, Spike.
All right, you too.
Later. That's our good buddy Spike, and rolling onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob.
Hey, Sandra.
Hey, listen, just a quick word. I mean, I'm just sort of blown away by the start of my air business. I mean, it's like some netherworld. I watched a little bit of it, but it was too painful. I had to turn it off because I was like, she, you know, is trying to back off of that. It's like, what the hell?
It is emotionally, viscerally, and physically embarrassing, isn't it?
No. When I was looking at Sessions, that freak, I being there, you ever seen that movie?
Yes, I have.
You know, that's what I thought of when I saw his dumb ass, and I was thinking about that quote from Louise, the black voice in the movie.
Oh, God, I got to watch it again now.
No, she just said, oh, you know, only in... it's a white man's world. Anyway, her quote is just amazing. It just sort of, that guy, Sessions. I mean, is that for real?
Yeah, he's real. And every six years, there are enough people in the state of Alabama who think just like him to return him to the Senate.
No, he is just a straight up
freak.
He seemed to be a little bit simple too. I realized he was a judge and everything.
Yeah, but see, there's an old gag out there among practicing lawyers who do trial law, and it goes a little something like this, Sandra. What do you call a lawyer with an IQ of 32? Answer, Your Honor. Because the great minds don't gravitate toward the bench, the hacks do.
God, because he's too much. But see, with that said, what I mainly wanted to say, though, was, you know, let's not be... fooled by this show, and I hate to go here, but you know I have to. Let me just read you this one thing. There is no reason for the business community to be concerned about Judge Sotomayor, said this lawyer from some corporate law firm. She basically was a part of the Second Circuit panel that ruled that investors could not proceed with a class action suit accusing Wall Street banks of fraudulently pricing initial public offers.
She most assuredly was.
But the thing is, it's interesting in lieu of Matt Taibbi, you know, rant about Goldman Sachs, that was their whole deal, the initial public offering. And, you know, the whole, you know, I'm just saying, look at the bigger picture. Obama has picked, you know, someone that believes in corporate personhood. You know, there's that side of it, which is going to come up much more frequently in this court than the other issues they're bringing about, the business issues. And with that, her will always be with the business, pretty much, from what I can tell. So, I mean, that's what I'm sorry. I just have to go there. I'm so over the race, all the value, all these issues, because at the end of the day, if you can't afford to eat, you know, who cares, right, about race and abortion and all that stuff, right? The bread and butter issues is what it all comes down to, and it's getting pretty desperate out there. So
yeah, a lot less bread, a lot less butter.
Yeah, so I'm just, you know, and I'm not saying that. She seems to be fairly even-handed on her decisions.
Yeah, but look, I mean, you know as well as I do, Sandra, that you do not rise to the level of the bench, even if you're one of the smart ones. You do not rise to the level of the bench without having a certain element of deference toward the process itself. Now, I'm not saying, you know, ooh, anarchy, let's go turn over a mailbox or anything. But the bench is, by definition, the most conservative institution in this country. Even if you are deemed to be a liberal jurist, that's, you know, liberal on a different kind liberal in a different kind of spectrum. It's a different kind of... It means that once in a while, you might exhibit a little bit of mercy toward a moron who's in front of you.
Well, you know, it's just sort of the whole... You know, I mean, I don't know where I heard this, but it just sort of stuck in my mind about Obama and the whole scene there. It's this sort of business liberal. You know, it's just... That seems to just stick with me when I think about this crew. And her appointment... It doesn't deviate much from that. I mean, I think these people are even worse than the DLC types. You know, they're real sort of corporatists, you know?
Yeah, I do.
I mean, you know, there's no, you know, it just seems to be just that way. And it's not like a huge criticism on her. I mean, she seems to know what she's doing. At least she doesn't, she's not like that chick that Bush picked. Remember
Harriet?
Her name?
Harriet?
Yeah.
Who wrote the nice thank you notes?
All right. This woman actually does seem like she, you know, is you know, she knows exactly what she's doing. Although the secret women's group, I'm a bit scared of. You know about that, right?
Yes, I do. I don't like any secret anything groups.
You know, that is kind of freaky. But these Republicans are just sort of, they're so unhinged. It's so bizarre.
But that's where they have to be. That's the, you know, that's the dog and pony show. Because, see, I guarantee you that whenever it is that Jeff Sessions comes up for reelection, A, the Democratic Party in Alabama will not have a credible challenger, and B, he will run lots of footage of him being tough on the brown woman, you know, and all over Alabama. You know, see, that's the thing. You can run ads in Alabama where you say, Senator Sessions stood up for our conservative Alabama family values when he said that civil rights were rammed down our throats. Makes you kind of proud of Senator Sessions, don't it? Vote for Senator Sessions on November the 6th. And that'll play down there.
Well, listen, I did find that quote. This was the part that had me rolling. It said, she said, oh, it's for sure a white man's world in America. And she said, all I have to say right now, he never learned to read and write. No, sir, had no brains at all, was stuffed with rice pudding between the ears.
That, yeah.
Short-changed by the Lord and dumb as a jackass.
Short-changed by the Lord and yeah.
I mean, but I just felt bad for her, you know, how she was, you know what I mean, trying to back. It's like, don't bother. I mean, there's no way that she's not going to be confirmed, right? I can't imagine.
No, she's going to be confirmed.
And so this is, but it's just, and it's, I couldn't even watch it. You know, like I said, it was kind of painful to look at. But the only other thing I wanted to mention before I'll let you go is you saw them earnings. It was even worse than I thought. It was like $3.4 billion.
Yeah. It's a good day to be working for Goldman Sachs. And bonus is coming, man. Bonus is coming.
It's just hideous. I mean, I was.
But what does this, but what does that say, Sandra, about this attempt to reinflate the bubble? Oh, look, it's only quarterly earnings, and they're doing $2.4 billion worth of profit. Yeah, I guess. Yeah, was that some sort of economic kabuki theater where everybody goes, oh well, the worst must be past now.
Well, no, and not only that, but they rewrite the rules. Like they had an orphan month of December that they were able to eliminate from their reports. You know. They only had a negative reporting once in the history of the organization, and that was during the high point of the crisis. And now they changed the organization into a holding bank and business as usual, renaming assets. I realize all this stuff just sounds just ridiculous, but I'm just sort of flabbergasted by how they're just chugging along, you know?
The condemned ate heartily, Sandra.
It's just too much. Anyway, you know, I don't know. I'm kind of, you know, a bit stunted, I guess, or just sort of shocked by everything. So I'll just keep it short.
Well, you have a great evening, okay?
Okay, you too.
All right, talk to you soon, Sandra.
Bye.
Bye now. Oh, have you ever seen Being There? I had forgotten it. Yeah. Rice pudding between his ears, shortchanged by the Lord and dumb as a jackass. Peter Sellers in the title role, of course, of Chance. It's hard not... Louise's description... I will speak to Louise. Louise's description is Jefferson Beauregard Sessions to a T, but my God, you watch Chance, and except for the fact that he's not malevolent and hateful, George Bush up and down. If you have not, and it's based on the book by Jerzy Kosinski, if you've not seen that film lately or never, watch it. You'll enjoy it. You'll laugh your ass off. It's a brilliant film. And there are just sort of transitory moments in it that'll stop you in your tracks. And rice pudding between his ears. Yeah. Shortchanged by the Lord and dumber than a jackass is one of them. Thanks, Sandra. Let's see if... No? Okay. So we're 4 minutes before the hour, and it's time to bail out. Let me just say something real quick. I make this little passing mention every night that we need your help to stay afloat. And like I said, it's a month until Netroots Nation. It is a month until we will bring you and anybody else who wants to hear it all of the proceedings from Netroots Nation. And the cupboard, as they say, is bare. It doesn't just put the Netroots Nation gig in jeopardy. It puts all of this in jeopardy. And I'm seriously in earnest about that. So if you have not contributed lately to the Horn, and you have the ability to do so, it's sincerely appreciated, I assure you. If you have never contributed to the Horn, and this means something to you, and you have the ability, this would be a great time. If you just can't, we understand that too. These are hard times. Despite $2.4 billion in profits from Goldman Sachs. That's what I need. I need a job at Goldman Sachs. And do this at night. That'd work. Thanks to Peter Godbold, our IT professional. Thanks to John Fox, our chief engineer, chief musician, web designer, webmaster, and host of All Foxed Up Sunday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Hope John is back up and about and able to go next Sunday night. Thanks to Ben Birch, the hardest working man in liberal talk, whiterosesociety.org. That's how all these streams and podcasts reach you. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and coalriverwind.org. If change will ever come to West Virginia, it will be in large part due to the hard work that Coal River Mountain Watch has been doing, does, and continues to do. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.
1 minute.
This is it.
Let's get this over with.
So this is good. We got problems.
One question before we proceed.
You count down. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Guy James here with you today. How are you? Get those guys to shut off the music. Thank you, guys, for shutting off the music today. Hope you're doing okay today, wherever you are. There, that's a little better. Now I can hear myself. Couldn't hear myself. I'm having one of those days. I'm a time freak, as anybody that knows me knows. And I'm one of those people that are early for everything I ever do. I'd like to know how many hours. 1,000 hours probably I have spent in my life sitting waiting because I got someplace early. I always think it's going to save me time. Sometimes it does at the doctor's office, but I always get to the airport, you know, so that I had a chance to fix 4 flat tires on the way to the airport. Are you like that? I'm just nuts about it. I've got 3 alarm clocks. And the odd thing is, I rarely ever wake up to an alarm clock. Rarely ever. I got some sort of a built-in clock. Why am I telling you all this? Welcome to the Guy James Show. You're listening to the Head On Radio Network. We're going to be with you for the next couple of hours. Going to do something a little different today. Going to stay away from politics as much as I possibly can today. I don't know about you, but I'm just sick of it. And once in a while, I just have to take a day and kind of stay away from it. I might mention it a time or two. I'm sure I will. But I'm not going to base the whole show today around politics. I'd like to talk about money today. I'd like to talk about credit cards. I'd like to talk about the credit crunch. I'd like to talk about how you, in particular, are dealing with the financial times that we're in right now. I know it's changed my life. I know it's changed the lives of many of my friends. And a lot of people are living very, very differently right now. A lot of people living very frugally. Now, I normally do live very frugally. I haven't always in my life. But for the past few years, I've lived very, very, like a tightwad because I've had to. You got Limbaugh on the air bragging about how much money he makes, and I'm on the air bragging about how little. There you go. It's one of those things that a lot of people, I now read that one out of every 5 homes, the people that have mortgages are upside down. 1 out of 5, imagine that. A lot of people are upside down in their automobiles. I'm reading that here locally anyway, 1 out of every 26 homes is in foreclosure. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine driving down the street and seeing 1 out of every 26 homes in foreclosure? That's just an astronomical number. It's really hard to believe And then when you look at the court system here in Lee County, Florida, anyway, where they have a 29,000, I'm not kidding, a backlog of 29,000 foreclosures. And they're still coming in at the rate of a couple of thousand a month. So I guess it's not hard to understand when you drive down the street that one out of every 26 or 27 homes is in foreclosure. It's an amazing number. Really, truly is an amazing number. But what do you do? What do you do? Just hope things do. Hope things get better. Anyway, if you'd like to join us here on the program today, 866-546-5254. 866-546-5254. Love to have you join us today. If you've got a comment about anything we have to say about financial conditions here in the country, love to hear where you're at. Love to hear if you're doing okay. Are you facing foreclosure? Or have you got a mountain of credit card bills? Where are you at? We'd like to know. I would like to know. And you don't have to give your name or anything, but if you call in, I would like to hear how things are in your financial home, in your bank account, in with your credit cards. But we do want to talk about that a little bit today. I will mention somebody else's credit card bill. I saw this note on the news today, Splash News, the Madoff, you know, Mr. Madoff, Bernie Madoff. His family might not have known about his Ponzi scheme, but they sure reaped its rewards. According to court records, Bernie Madoff's relatives and employees routinely charged tens of thousands of dollars a month on his corporate American Express account. The New York Post reports that Madoff's son, Mark, racked up nearly $81,000 in charges in July of 2008, with more than $77,000 going into charter flights. Big-ticket items purchased by the Hyrolin family included $2,000 dropped in the Giorgio Armani store in Paris by the Ponzi schemer's wife, Ruth. That's not so much, $2,000 in a Giorgio Armani store. That ought to buy you a cheap purse in there. Son Andrew went on a shopping spree at Polo Ralph Lauren in June 2008, spending almost $2,400 in a single visit. Again, that's not so much. That ought to buy you a Ralph Lauren store, maybe five or six shirts. 18 people held cards for the corporate account, most of them firm employees, except for sister-in-law Marion Madoff, daughter-in-law Deborah Madoff, and the captain of Madoff's yacht, Richard Carroll. Bernie's sister-in-law's name actually appeared in the company's payroll with an annual salary of $163,500 a year, although there is no evidence, according to the records, that she did any work whatsoever for the company. Well, isn't that interesting? Everybody needs an uncle like that, or a father-in-law like that, I guess. If you had that kind of money, and you spent that kind of money, would you get tired of it? I don't know about you, but when I am able to buy something that's a luxury, enjoy a really fine meal out or something, maybe in past years get a new automobile or you know, a new suit or buy a home or something, you just felt so good about it. And it was such an achievement that you were able to buy something that you really wanted, something that you really desired, something that was within your means, but nonetheless had to save up for and work hard for, whether you bought it with cash or credit.